And this is KPCW, or listening to the local news hour here on KPCW. Let's find out what we've got in store for the weather this weekend. Here with a report, we have Cedric Haynes from the ABC 4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Friday. We're looking at mostly sunny to partly sunny skies as we move throughout today. Temperatures a little warmer than where they have been the past few days, with highs returning back into the mid-50s in Park City. We'll see those highs right around 60 in the Heber Valley. As we go into your weekend, the weekend starts off nice and calm out there, with Saturday featuring partly cloudy skies. We'll start off with temperatures in the upper 20s, with highs climbing into the mid-50s over towards Park City. We'll see those highs in the low 60s in the Heber Valley. Our next storm system, a deeper storm system, moves our way as we go into your Sunday. That will bring us in a better chance of widespread precipitation. We're going to be talking about the chances of valley rain and mountain snow moving in. The snow levels will be around 8,000 feet on Sunday, dropping to about 6,500 feet Sunday night into Monday. So overall, expect the chance of scattered valley rain throughout the day on your Sunday in the Heber Valley. And in Park City and areas above that, we're looking at that chance of rain and snow changing over to snow showers Sunday night into Monday, with some accumulations expected, again, above about 7,000 feet. Meanwhile, as we go into your Monday, we'll keep that chance of showers and even a couple of rumbles of thunder down into the valley areas throughout the day on Monday, with that chance of rain and snow mix making its way through the Park City area. We'll see those highs in the 40s in Park City, with highs into the low 50s in the Heber Valley. Once we move into your Tuesday, we'll have a chance of a few snow showers still sticking around the Park City areas, particularly for your Tuesday morning. Otherwise, we should start to dry things out. Low 30s for you as you kick off the day in Park City, with highs eventually getting back close to 50 in the afternoon in Park City on Tuesday. We'll see those highs in the upper 50s to near 60 on Tuesday afternoon in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into your Wednesday and Thursday, we're going to be seeing a mixture of sun and clouds. There's a slim chance of an isolated shower or two during this time. Temperatures moderating back into the 50s in Park City and in the 60s in the Heber Valley. Let's look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch back on ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up, I'll be speaking with Kendra Wyckoff, the executive director of Peace House, Liz Watson, the Peace House chief program director, and Dana Thomas, Wasatch forensic nurse executive director. Then Patrick Elliott of the Freedom from Religious Freedom from Religion Foundation, but I can't say that three times in a war, will call in to discuss HB 312. That's the new law that includes guidance on teaching the Bible in public schools here in Utah. Last week, I spoke to the sponsor of that bill, Representative Tiara Oxier, to get her perspective. We'll finish our hour by speaking with Park City Water Development Conservation Coordinator Susan Cardone and Lisa Hoffman, Assistant General Manager for Mountain Regional Water. Stay tuned. Earth is being turned on construction projects throughout Park City, and contaminated soil is top of mind. KPCW's Christine Weller has more on the rules in place to protect the community's health.
Most locals know Park City's soil is contaminated with lead, arsenic, and other heavy metals due to its mining history. So when construction projects across the city begin, health concerns are bound to arise. Construction has been ongoing at the Park City School District's Currens campus since the summer of 2025, including where Treasure Mountain Junior High previously stood. Treasure Mountain is in a special category of land, as the site is part of an environmental covenant between the Environmental Protection Agency and the Park City School District. Anytime soil is disturbed in the area, a 6-inch cap of clean soil, defined as 200 parts per million of lead or less, must be placed on top. The covenant also has requirements on timing. Crews must place a cap within 30 days of construction activity or soil disturbance. After breaking those rules starting in 2018, the district says it's being more diligent when it comes to soil. Department of Environmental Quality spokesperson Dave Noriega said the district has followed the rules since the project began, and there's no public safety risk. Construction on Dozier Field, less than half a mile away, has different requirements. Dozier Field, less than half a mile away, doesn't fall under the covenant, but on top of state rules, it must follow Park City's soil cover ordinance. Adopted in 1988, Park City's Ryan Blair said it also defines soil as clean if lead levels are 200 parts per million or less. The definition doesn't mention other heavy metals, Blair said, because lead is a good indicator for contamination.
If you tackle lead, you kind of take care of the other contaminants. If you can get down to that level on lead, you can get down to a safe level for arsenic and all those other things.
He said the ordinance is not proactive, only triggering when a shovel hits the dirt. When soil is moved, often for construction, the ordinance requires a 6-inch cap of approved topsoil, as well as dust control measures. That could include watering or a tarp covering a soil pile. As for construction not within the ordinance, Blair said there are still state and federal regulations to keep the community safe. Blair said it's also unlikely Park City soil would become a safety hazard given the regulations in place, but it's all about magnitude and scope. For public health to be impacted, he said locals would need repeated exposure over years.
It would be years of walking by that construction site and breathing in that dust, or multiple instances of eating dirt that's heavily contaminated.
That's why the Soil Ordinance and Environmental Covenant prioritize a cap. It provides a physical barrier between humans and the contaminated material. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, April is National Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Here to talk about that and to update us on a new federal grant awarded to Peace House, we welcome back Kendra Wyckoff, the Executive Director of Peace House, Liz Watson, the Peace House Chief Program Officer, and Dana Thomas, Wasatch Forensic Nurses Executive Director. Good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Roger.
So, Kendra, let me ask you to kick it off. Tell me, what is the significance of National Sexual Assault Awareness Month?
Well, you know, the significance is about raising awareness of this very prevalent crime that occurs in our communities, very underreported crime. This is the 25th year of the National Sexual Assault Awareness Month. I think what's important for people to understand is that people who care about these issues, who are involved in this work, people in the community that are concerned about sexual assault victimization are often working to create awareness throughout the year. But this is an opportunity for us to really focus in on the issue, provide some additional education, highlight the prevalence in our communities, the resources, and the efforts that our communities are making to be able to prevent violence and abuse.
And have you had some programs this month to sort of draw the community's attention to these issues?
Yeah, we've had some social media pieces that we have done. We're running a campaign there so that people understand what resources are available. We've been involved in also child abuse prevention activities during this month as well. So we're trying to kind of manage both of the messaging so that people understand, you know, the importance of preventing violence and abuse from, you know, youth all the way into adulthood. But one of the things that we'll be doing specifically at Peace House, and this is more of an internal opportunity, but will be what we call celebrating Denim Days. And Denim Days is really a specific movement. There was a young woman in Europe who was sexually assaulted, and the offender's defense was that he could not have removed her pants because they were tight jeans without her consent. And so, you know, it signifies that it doesn't matter what you're wearing, where you're at, whether or not you're, you know, consuming alcohol, walking in the streets by yourself, that women especially do not do anything to ask for sexual assault, that they're not responsible for the assault, that it is about the offender and their offense, essentially.
Okay, well, I understand that there is big news at Peace House, which is that you've gotten your first and a very substantial federal grant. Liz, you want to tell us about that? Or Kendra, who wants that ball?
Well, we'll ping pong for a moment. I'll just say we are really, really proud of this effort because this took a lot of organizing and work with our community partners, with Wasatch Forensic Nurses, with many of the criminal justice system partners here in Summit County. And we're really excited. It is a 3-year grant for $500,000. It's the first time that Peace House has actually received a direct grant from the Department of Justice Office on Violence Against Women. And I'm gonna hand it over to Liz and Dana to talk a bit more about what the purpose is, but we're really excited to have the opportunity to use these funds to support survivors and some of the community work we're doing here.
And before we get to the purpose, was this a joint application that you guys had to work on together? Tell us a little bit just about that process and what it took to get the grant.
Absolutely, thank you. It is what is known as a coordinated community response is what we're really trying to achieve through this grant process. And so part of that, while Peace House is the lead applicant and will be responsible for implementing most of the objectives, we did that in collaboration with the Summit County Attorney's Office, with the Summit County Sheriff's Office, Park City Police Department, Wasatch Forensic Nurses, and then the Asian Association of Utah, who specialize in supporting victims of human trafficking. And we brought all of those partners together to look at where the what are the needs of victims in our community here in Summit and also Wasatch County that Peace House serves, and how we can best come together to cover any gaps and to meet victims where they're at. So we really explored that together, and we will be working, meeting monthly, both to address domestic and sexual violence responses.
And I know you guys have worked collaboratively with some of these agencies before and do that on an ongoing basis, but I take it that the idea of doing a collective project like this with the associated funding really will cause that sort of integration of the community effort to come much tighter. Have I got that right?
Yeah, absolutely, Roger. I think that is the purpose. You know, it allows us to get some additional funding to support some initiatives and to fill some gaps in areas where we can come together and formalize a little bit more about, you know, how we respond to these issues in our community and develop protocols that hopefully close some of those gaps and shore up some of the barriers that we see for survivors.
Now, Kendra, you've obviously talked on the air before, but I don't know much about the Wasatch Forensic Nurses Group. Can you explain who you guys are?
Our organization has been around for about 24 years, and we service victims of sexual assault and interpersonal violence through forensic medical examinations. And we service patients throughout Salt Lake, Utah, Summit, and Wasatch counties. And we partner with Peace House and other victim advocacy agencies, law enforcement agencies, and hospitals. So we work with about 40 law enforcement agencies, 26 hospitals and clinics throughout our service areas, and our nurses respond to those hospitals to provide patient care. First and foremost, we want to make sure that victims receive medical care, and secondary to that is the forensic evidence collection. That evidence is then turned over to law enforcement so they can investigate the crime, and then the crime lab processes that evidence, and then hopefully perpetrators are held accountable for their crimes.
So you are the specialized medical resource that gets called in to the ER or a similar circumstance to ensure both appropriate care on the one hand and forensic collection on the other hand.
Yes.
Kind of like that great scene in The Pit this year.
Yes.
where we had that very careful process of collecting that evidence. Okay, so the grant comes in. Tell us a little bit more about some of the many things you're going to be able to do.
So we will be using the funds specifically with Wasatch Forensic Nurses. It's going to allow us to make exams for intimate partner violence, particularly when strangulation has been, or choking as most people call it, has been a factor. And there is specific evidence that Dana's team from Wasatch Forensic Nurses can look for, as well as making sure that those victims who may feel okay, who may look okay, who may sound okay, are thoroughly checked out at the emergency room, because many of the injuries can be invisible to the naked eye, but can be very serious. And so we want to make sure that there's understanding among our first responders as to the seriousness of those types of crime, and that we're ultimately able to hold offenders accountable, as well as that victims get the care that they need. And streamlining that process takes some time. There's lots of different factors. And unfortunately, the funding has not consistently been available across the United States, but also in the state of Utah, to enable victims to get that that exam.
It sounds like this is going to be both an education process to educate the emergency room, the quote regular end quote doctors, and also an increased sort of presence of the forensic nurses to do that. How prevalent is this kind of a strangulation situation in our area?
We do see quite a bit of strangulation, and unfortunately we find that that's on the increase, right? Mm-hmm. But I do think it is due to some of that education and just our nurses and the advocates having those conversations with not only physicians but patients, and being able to talk to them and let them know the seriousness and, you know, the likelihood of of things becoming lethal for them. So there are many different facets to that, but our nurses are trained in that. The advocates are trained on a lot of that. And law enforcement is also receiving training in those areas. And so us going into the hospital and being able to express that to the physicians and having them understand that, and then maybe ordering additional imaging or making sure that the survivors are medically okay has been very helpful.
Okay, that's one project. What are some others?
Well, I think some of the things that it specifically funds or helps fund at Peace House is a specialized position around healthcare coordination. That role really is focusing in on the healthcare needs of survivors. So including some of these forensic exams and, you know, working with the SANE nurses and working with the other medical providers. But it helps them not just deal with the immediate healthcare needs, but being able to manage healthcare needs, you know, longer term, and coordinating those services and supports. It also helps fund our lethality assessment protocol coordinator. So we've talked a little bit about that on the radio, but this particular assessment is utilized by law enforcement. It's mandated here in the state of Utah. It's 11 questions that has been that's been established through research. One of those questions is about choking, actually, mm-hmm. but it helps us understand the dangerousness of a victim's situation along with their story that they share with us. And we can utilize that information to be able to communicate amongst partners, so law enforcement directly to Peace House, because part of the protocol is to reach out to our hotline when they're on scene and they determine someone's high danger. But it's even going further than that, right? With these coordinated community response meetings, it's an opportunity to talk about cases, to be more educated so that we're ensuring that we're identifying those that are at highest risk and that we are taking, you know, steps to provide appropriate intervention and support so that we can do more and ensure that, you know, we can avoid the worst possible outcome, which is domestic violence homicide.
Hmm. Now, I noticed on your, I think it was your press release, the idea that you'd be increasing training, specialized instruction about human trafficking. Tell us a little bit about that element of the project.
So as I say, the Asian Association of Utah, they're based down in the Valley, but they serve the whole state, will be the expert organization there. I think many of us think human trafficking does not happen in the United States, or it happens only for foreign-born nationals maybe being brought into the country, whereas in actual fact, it's endemic. And we are at a crux point in when you think about our transportation routes with the interstates of the I-15, the I-80, et cetera. So there's a lot, and, you know, big events that can happen here. So there's a lot that goes on in tiny towns like Park City that does involve human trafficking, unfortunately. And so we're excited to be able to bring that resource of the Asian Association to help train everybody so that we are identifying, that we're aware, and that hopefully we're providing the right resources to victims of trafficking.
And another thing I saw in the press release was the idea of a program to reduce barriers to participation in the criminal justice process. Can you explain a little bit about what you're trying to get at there?
So we have purposely put aside funds. We spoke with the county attorney's office, with some of the prosecutors there, about what they see can cause a difficulty for folks attending court. There can be many emotional difficulties to attending court, but there can also be some real financial barriers. You know, we're a rural county. Transportation is not always easy. It could be as simple as just making sure that someone can get to court and safely and can get home safely. Equally, childcare. You know, unfortunately, it's many families that are impacted by this type of violence, and we want to make sure that the children are looked after so that the parent who has been abused can attend court and receive justice and hopefully safety through that process. And so, just those simple things like that. Then it's not rocket science, but we've got to find the funding to be able to provide that help. So we are going to have a joint fund that we will be utilizing with the system-based advocates that work at the county attorney's office and with law enforcement to try and meet some of those needs for some of those survivors who are brave enough to participate in that criminal justice system.
How significant a barrier is language with respect to both the medical end and the forensic end?
Yeah, so the hospitals usually provide interpreters. And so it's very nice for that service to be available so our nurses can communicate directly with a patient as opposed to trying to go through a family member or, you know, gather the information third party. So that's been very helpful. And then also when we reach out to do follow-up with patients, we have an interpretation service that we also utilize. And so again, we're able to directly work with the patients and get the information directly from them. So while there are language barriers and that can be a barrier to access, I do think that our community partners and our hospitals and law enforcement agencies are all working together to make sure that those barriers are lessened by utilizing various tools that we have and various agencies that we have that we can work with to lessen that impact for victims.
You know, our discussion this morning is focused on what I think of as two important, but they're touch points. We have, on the one hand, interaction with the medical community. On the other hand, interaction with the criminal justice system. But for listeners who may not be completely familiar with what you do, let's talk a little bit about the range of services that Peace House currently provides that certainly go outside of those two poles.
Yeah, thanks, Roger. Well, Peace House is a nonprofit organization that has been dedicated to ending interpersonal violence and abuse, and we do that through a number of different services. Most people are probably familiar with our emergency shelter. When individuals need to get out of an abusive or unsafe situation immediately, it's available 24/7. We have a 1-800 helpline. That's a way to access services and the emergency shelter, but it is also a place where people can call and they don't have to share their name. It can be confidential. They have the opportunity to just, you know, dip their fingers into the resource to understand what's available and what kind of support we can offer. We offer services on our campus for people who are living on our campus as well as people who are living in the community. We have a longer term housing program called transitional housing where people can live up to 2 years as they're rebuilding their life from violence. We also offer counseling. So we have, master's level clinicians that are specialized in modalities for trauma, for domestic violence and sexual assault survivors. We have case management advocates who work alongside every single family and every individual to help them get connected to resources, to assess danger, to continuously safety plan, and a legal advocate that helps with protective orders and stalking injunctions. And a lot of those folks that work in those different programs are working directly with some of these community partners, with the systems-based advocate at the Park City Police Department or, you know, at the county attorney's office. So we have what I would call a continuum of care on our campus where people can hopefully access through just about any door because there's 24/7 support. So even if someone can't make a phone call to our helpline, they can come to the door and ring the doorbell anytime, day or night, and an advocate is there to support them.
Okay, Kendra, before we go, tell people how to find you.
Yes. So if you need to reach out via phone, and I always encourage people, put this phone number in your telephone for your friends and family members if you can do so safely. It's 1-800-647-9161. That's available 24 hours a day. And then we are located just down the road from the Park City Hospital at 700 Round Valley Drive. So if an individual is not able to reach out to us via phone, they are able to just come right to our door anytime we are staffed around the clock to be able to provide support.
We've been speaking with Kendra Wyckoff, the Executive Director of Peace House, Liz Watson, the Chief Program Officer of Peace House, and Dana Thomas, Wasatch Forensic Nurses Executive Director. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much, Roger. We appreciate it.
We'll be right back after this. Well, last week, I got to speak with Representative Tierra Oxier about the HB 312 legislation she sponsored in the last legislative session, which, among other things, mandates the incorporation of religious texts referenced or alluded to in the U.S. historical documents in public school curriculum. But today, we're joined by Patrick Elliott of the Freedom from Religion Foundation to get his perspective on the law and its implications. Morning, Patrick, and thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Okay, Patrick, let's do a little bit more of the big picture. How would you summarize the provisions of HB 312 with respect to the teaching of religion in public schools?
Yeah, you know, at the broad level, I mean, this is really pushing a false Christian nationalist narrative, and that is that America was founded on Christian principles rather than our entirely secular constitution. And so, again, at the broad level, the law does not really present fair and accurate social studies standards It's really pushing a religious narrative that's connecting our government to Christianity. And I think that's going to be, you know, prove to be problematic for many families in Utah.
And I did notice when I looked at the bill that there are a lot of references to portions of the Declaration of Independence where there are references, I think, to biblical sources, but I didn't see any references to the Constitution. Do you think that's a coincidence?
Right. No, there's no coincidence. I think, and you're right, that there's this hyper-focus on some use of religious phrases in the Declaration of Independence rather than a comprehensive study of the document or a comprehensive study of the U.S. Constitution, which is, you know, the foundation for our actual government. So I think it's the choices here are very intentional. And I think it just generally is bizarre, you know, some of the things that are focused on that the state legislature put into this bill. You know, this is not something developed by education experts to decide what types of content would be most appropriate. They wanted to insert religion and connect it to the government. It's pretty plain when you look at some of the provisions of the bill.
As a practical matter, how do you think this is going to like play out in the classroom?
Yeah, I think it'll be disastrous. I know it's going to take some time for that to happen. But really, educators and I think families don't want this, right? This is something that's been pushed on them and they're going to have to deal with that. And practically, our public school classrooms are not Sunday schools, right? I don't think the teachers are going to be fully equipped to deal with how do we teach the Bible in a neutral and objective manner and do this impossible task of connecting it to U.S. history versus, you know, something that'd be more appropriate, you know, in the church setting or at home. Here, educators are going to be put in a really tough spot. I don't know how practically the curricular materials are going to be developed. You know, they're likely going to be problematic, you know, in terms of trying to fit all the provisions of these standards. And then this is about to teach children as young as 8 years old. So we're not talking about, I did hear the representative mention, you know, this is the type of thing that's done in college, but we're not talking about fully mature students who can understand the full context of learning about a religious text from an objective way. We're talking about kids as young as 8 years old and elementary school students. I think this is will be proven to be problematic in the classroom.
Yeah, and on its face, it says that they are to be teaching sort of history and not doctrine. And I read that several times, and I'm trying to figure out how you would do that.
Yeah, I think it's just a Trojan horse. You know, in order to write a bill that doesn't get immediately struck down as unconstitutional, they could pretend that we're going to do this in this fair way and in a non-devotional way, which is theoretically possible to teach in a constitutional way. But practically, they want, you know, public schools to be teaching people's kids about Bible stories. And that's going to be a very difficult task to do, especially given the age groups involved.
Okay, so there have been a number of initiatives in recent years with respect to religion in schools. And I take it you guys track that pretty closely. How does this legislation compare to what you've seen in other states?
Yeah, I think this is a national trend. You know, we've seen this in other states where there are these, you know, there are government officials that want public schools to become more involved in religion. And so some of the bills in other states, and some of these have passed, you know, are looking to put prayer into school classrooms, to have schools hire religious chaplains, to put religious texts in classrooms. And so I think this, it's clear that this Utah law is, you know, part of that larger trend. And I think it's dishonest to the citizens of the state to pretend, you know, this is about improving civics education or social studies standards. It really is a way to try to teach Christianity and to use schools to do it rather than the appropriate place, again, being, you know, something that's personal to families and to their churches or for the over one third of people in Utah who are not religious. You know, this is not something they want undertaken at all by either within the school or outside of the school. So I just think it fits that larger trend. It's unique. I don't think a state has passed anything this specific, you know, at the legislative level to say what phrases in the Declaration of Independence need to be taught in schools. I've never seen that anywhere else. That would be the kind of decision you'd hope would be local to a school board or to even a particular teacher within curriculum. You know, how are we going to teach a particular subject matter? I think it's micromanaging curriculum. So I have not seen that in other bills, but it fits that larger trend of trying to get religion back into schools.
Let's talk about the constitutional lens with which provisions of this sort have been viewed in the past and how that seems to be evolving a bit at the Supreme Court level.
Yeah, you're right that has changed over the years. So we had for about 50 years, the court had developed a kind of a standard test to determine if an action was violating the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. And that seemed to have worked pretty well. But recently, that is in 2022, the Supreme Court had kind of jettisoned that test and said, now we need to look at these questions more to decide whether, to be understood in reference to historic practices and understandings. And so there's a little bit more of an open question of what types of things will violate the First Amendment. Even so, in the public school context, the court has not really wavered on that. Schools cannot coerce students to, participate in religion. They can't misuse school resources to teach religion in a devotional way. And so the court has been very strong on that. And I don't think that has changed, even though there has been some evolution on other types of practices that might now be more permissible. The court has wavered a bit and has broadened it. And I think, again, we think that's a problem. I think that will prove to also be problematic for what people want and how government interacts. But schools are still a place that people expect to not, teach religion or to violate the rights of conscience of students.
As you read the football coach prayer case? Was that 2 years ago? It does seem to be nibbling on the edges, at least.
Right. And in that case, at least the Supreme Court said, well, this was the coach who wanted to engage in prayer was not doing it with students. He was not doing it in coercing them in any way. And so in saying that, the court at least had referenced that type of thing could be problematic. Teachers pushing a religion on kids would still be problematic.
So do you expect this legislation to be challenged here in Utah?
I think it will be. It may take some time because this is going to take a few years to play out as curriculum materials get developed and schools have to implement it. We have to see how that's going to actually be implemented. I think it's an impossible task that the legislature has set up. I hope at some point they wise up and would undo this law. But in the interim, there's state officials and then school boards and teachers are going to have to deal with this. Our organization, the Freedom of Religion Foundation, and other groups, would be interested in challenging this if things are taught in an improper way. And we hear from families when that happens. We've challenged prior religious instruction in schools and have won cases on that. So I think it's going to take some time, but I do expect that there would likely be a challenge at some point.
I guess it wouldn't be ripe yet because you don't actually have an actual curriculum to challenge. Is that as a practical matter, is that basically right?
Yeah, I think, and even if it is ripe, we may want to look at exactly how this is being taught just for the benefit of what these families are going to have to experience. I think it's helpful to the courts and for families to understand what's planned in schools.
And I wanted to ask you while I have you is we had other developments in the religion and schools legal world this week. As I understand it, the Fifth Circuit in what they call an en banc decision upheld a Texas law requiring the display of the Ten Commandments in public schools. Tell us a little bit more about that case and the significance of the decision in the Fifth Circuit.
Yeah, I think that's what's fitting that larger trend that I mentioned, that we have a few states, including Texas, that had passed laws mandating a specific version of the Ten Commandments to go up in public school classrooms across the state. There's 5.5 million public school kids in Texas that were impacted by this. So we, along with the ACLU and Americans United and other organizations, sued and challenged that and blocked the law and blocked the implementation in the school districts where we had sued. This week, the Fifth Circuit said that this was actually permissible, that they overturned the lower court and did not find this to be problematic. We obviously disagree with that. There is a binding Supreme Court case from 1980 that says a Kentucky law that did the same thing was unconstitutional, posting the Ten Commandments in public school classrooms. So we think this is ripe for the Supreme Court to take this challenge and to overturn that decision this week. And so we anticipate filing with the Supreme Court to reverse this decision.
Now, am I correct? And I'm not sure. Was this the entire Fifth Circuit? Was this an en banc where all the judges were involved?
Correct. And that decision was a 9-8 decision. So normally you have a 3-judge panel. This was the full panel of judges in the Fifth Circuit.
And that's a pretty conservative circuit. It's interesting to me that was actually that close. Patrick, what's the time frame for when, as a practical matter, would we see a cert petition going up for possibly the next term?
Yes. So usually you have 90 days to do that. So again, this is just a brand new decision. We anticipate filing it. And so is likely to be decided. The Supreme Court will decide this fall whether to take this case.
Okay, Patrick, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
No, I appreciate this, and thanks for having me on.
Michael Murphy, a Republican candidate for Wasatch County Council, will serve as an interim council member until January. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports he fills a vacancy after Carl McMillan resigned.
Former Wasatch County Council Chair Carl McMillan resigned due to illness at the beginning of April, leaving the body with an empty seat. Councilmember Eric Rowland said at a meeting Wednesday it was up to the Wasatch County GOP to fill the spot.
So the name that was submitted to us is Michael Murphy. All we need to do is entertain a motion to approve that nomination, and he will be appointed as the interim council member until the end of the year.
Murphy will be sworn in on May 6th to represent Hideout, Timber Lakes, and the eastern side of the county. The Republican is running for a full term in the seat against Democratic challenger Joseph Tugaw. He said at the county GOP convention he cares about keeping government local, promoting family-friendly policies, and advocating for fiscal responsibility. He lives in Timber Lakes, works as a defense contractor, and serves on the Wasatch County Planning Commission. Also Wednesday, the council decided how to manage McMillan's other duties. Former Vice Chair Eric Rowland was appointed as the council's new chairperson. Luke Searle will serve as vice chair. The council also chose Rowland to represent Wasatch County on the board of the Military Installation Development Authority. His name will be submitted to the governor for approval. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, this summer certainly looks like it could be a dry one, yesterday's snow notwithstanding. By the way, I don't know why Cedric had to mention snow for the first time in weeks today after we had none of it during the months when we really wanted it, but I digress. The need to conserve water is a long-term issue for this community. Joining me in the studio to discuss Park City's Landscape Incentive Program, we have Susan Cardone, and we have Lisa Hoffman to discuss a similar program with Mountain Regional Water. Good morning, and thanks for joining me.
Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Okay. So let me start with you, Susan. Why is a program of this type important?
Well, we would, you know, it's our goal in Park City to provide great water quality to our customers and our visitors. And it's also our goal to help those visitors and customers conserve it. So this is, ours is called a landscape incentive program, and we just believe that it's a good opportunity if folks are already thinking about potentially removing their turf or changing their landscape out. This is hopefully some sort of an incentive to help them do that.
And is this the first year of the program, or has it been going on for a while?
It's been going on for a while, since 2023, I think we launched.
Yeah, 2023.
And Mountain Regional has been running a similar program in parallel during
Mountain
that whole
Regional
time frame.
Participates as well, okay. And we've been running it since 2023.
And I take it that, you know, when you're trying to create a community to conserve water, we have carrots and sticks. We have nudges and benefits. And right now, I think we're focusing on what I would call the nudge side, right? You're trying to create an environment that encourages people to modify their landscape and thereby their behavior.
Totally.
Okay.
You were mentioning that conservation is...
It's a 24/7, 365 here in Utah. If we're not in a drought, we're preparing for one. So I think it's always on the top of our mind, and this program really took off, like we said, in 2023 after we had those really, really high drought conditions in 2022. Mm-hmm. But that followed, you know, a pretty large snowpack the following year. So while we put those in place, people already had it on the top of their mind to try to, what can we do to help conserve water in our community? And so, you know, we're thinking about it all the time.
This may be a curveball, but put in perspective, when you think about the water use in our community, obviously we use it to drink, we use it to bathe. How much of it do we use? How big a deal is the use of landscaping and grass in particular? Is it a big, big water usage?
I'm going to go with half, actually.
It's that
yes.
High.
What about you, Lisa?
And based on our recent, probably last 2 years of data, when we've had a little bit higher usage, we're about 60% outdoor, 40% indoor. It's significant.
Mm-hmm. And it's not like we have a big agricultural community that we're talking about. The we're really talking about people's lawns, right?
Exactly. Correct.
So there is sort of a trend, if you will, toward zero-scaping and other things. Talk to us about how your landscape program works to encourage that. Who wants to take it first?
Sure, I'll take it. So we encourage water use reduction via turf removal. Turf is a live turf, of course, is a very, very thirsty plant. So we are asking our customers to remove any desired non functional turf, you know, the kind of turf that the dogs aren't playing on, the kids aren't out, and so forth. So it's the removal of the turf and then replanting 50% plant material that is low water use and fire resistant in the area in which the land, the turf was removed.
Okay, talk to us about what kind of ground cover fits that low water usage fire resistance model.
Yeah, we're looking at more of the native species that we have, kind of removing the turf that Susan was talking about and putting in some more of the native drought-tolerant plants. Mm-hmm. In our landscape program, we do have a plant list that we recommend to folks that that fit the criteria for the program. While we don't, Park City does, as Susan mentioned, require fire-resistant. We don't require fire-resistant, but we always recommend that we would definitely encourage those kinds of plantings in and around the area where the turf has been removed.
And just so people can get a sense of why this works. Do you have sort of a ballpark of if I took, you know, 10 square yards, okay, of grass and I replaced it with what you're talking about, what would be either a percentage, what kind of a reduction in water usage would I see?
Well, it also is contingent upon the fact that you're also removing overhead spray from the live turf, right? And you are replacing it
with the sprinklers, yes.
Right, so drip irrigation. So there's a component of both what I'd like to say is behavioral efforts and device-driven efforts. So you're likely, and part of the program is to remove overhead spray.
That's a requirement, isn't it?
Exactly. Okay. And then as well as providing drip irrigation into the landscape. So you're not only getting a less thirsty plant, you're also providing the most high technology devices for.
And does it really
irrigation.
Make a big difference in terms of the water use per any sort of square footage?
Yes, so I will say a metric that the state of Utah provided to me as we were trying to turn that square foot of turf removed into water savings. They said for every square foot removed up in every area is different, depend on your elevation, your evapotranspiration. Park City area, it's about 25 gallons saved per square foot of turf removed. So, yeah. So it's significant.
Yeah, I'm doing the math.
It's
right?
significant. Yeah. So in our case, we have, in Mountain Regional, we've had just over 20 customers participate in the program, and we've removed about 40,000 square feet of turf. So that equates to about, we've reimbursed on that $3 a square foot, as Susan said. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at close to 1 million gallons of water saved annually.
Yeah.
So that's awesome. Forever. So it's a big deal. And like I said, that was 20 customers. If we can get 20 more, mm-hmm. I mean, that builds upon itself. And we're really making some progress. It's those, like you've said, those small steps mm-hmm. really do make a big difference.
And let's go back to the use of overhead sprays. I mean, mm-hmm. You drive through a neighborhood here in Park City and you'll see sprinklers, right?
Sure.
And it's certainly seen in golf courses, but you see sprinklers. Is that? I take it that's a pretty inefficient way to irrigate, but it's the only way to irrigate regular grass? I mean, as a practical matter?
Yes. It can be inefficient. I mean, timing is important. Our ordinance in Park City Municipal Area requires that you cannot irrigate after 10 a.m. or before 7 p.m. So 10 to 7, no irrigation. You've got, wind, evapotranspiration, like we were talking about. And so, the timing is really important, obviously. I have one of my big pet peeves, and I've said this before, is when I've seen a rain event and the person has their irrigation on because it's on a timer. And nowadays there are what's called smart irrigation controllers that will detect a rain event and shut the entire system off.
I did see some sprinklers going yesterday in the snow.
Yeah, that's so bothersome to me.
I'm sure you would have been appalled.
Oh, yeah, it's a problem. I have a little problem with that. But it's also going to snow and rain this weekend, right? Mm-hmm. I'd like to encourage folks to not turn on their irrigation for a little while, until it's practical. So, but going back to overhead spray, there's new technology. So a lot of people do want to keep their turf. So I would say look at the new types of spray bodies and nozzles. There's types that are more efficient than the old, brass types, and so it's something to work on.
So let's be very specific now for someone who's listening and go, that's an interesting idea. What exactly would I have to do to qualify for this program? And what would happen if I did qualify? What would I be able to get?
Well, you first need to know who your water provider is.
Okay, let's assume you're fortunate enough to have Mountain Regional.
Okay, well, you're fortunate enough to have Mountain Regional. Then you can go directly to our website. We have a conservation hub right at the top of our list of choices. You click on that conservation hub, and it goes right to our landscape lawn exchange programs, as well as our other conservation programs that we're currently taking on, and you start with an application. Mm-hmm. So fill out the application, you make sure that you are a Mountain Regional customer, you're in, and our customer service team will reach out to you if that day, the following day. And then we get set up with a meeting in person, so we have our customer service team will come out and we will talk with you about the design that you're interested in doing. We will measure the area that you're interested in replacing and start to look at your landscape plan and what that looks like and if it meets the criteria.
And is this likely to end up, for most people, being a three-way conversation where you'll actually have a landscape contractor as part of the dialogue?
It can, and some people like to do it yourself.
They can do it themselves?
Yeah, you can do it yourself. You can hire someone to do that with you. There are some very sophisticated plans that we see. There are some very much just a sketch plan, and that's okay. We are open to anything in between.
And if, and I take it Park City, similar process,
absolutely.
Basically identical.
Yes.
Okay, so if you're accepted into the program, what's the financial, you know, where's the juice here? What's the financial incentive?
It's $3 a square foot, and that is the same for Mountain Regional.
Same, yep.
So, yep, and it has to be live, well-maintained turf. So,
it has been existing.
Yes.
I can't just take the dead spot in the backyard and go, aha, you'll give me $3 back. Yeah. No.
Exactly. Yeah. So.
So regular, well-maintained turf, and that's a one-time payment of $3 a square foot.
That is correct.
Okay.
Yes.
And how many? You've mentioned you've had some 20-odd participants
correct.
And saved a million gallons.
Mm-hmm.
What are your statistics in Park City?
So we have, I didn't do the math all the way through, but yeah, we have removed about 65,000 square feet of turf here in Park City. And we've had a couple of HOAs and single family dwellings as well. So we're, I think the HOAs have had more turf.
Sure.
So therefore that kind of brings the numbers up. But yeah, we are ready, willing, and able to work with any type of customer.
I was gonna say, have you seen much, that was my question. Have you seen significant commercial interest? Because obviously you can drive around Park City and see some pretty big commercial lawns.
Right, yeah. I'm ready to speak with anybody that has a desire to help our community save water through this program.
Okay, anything else you wanna touch on? Before I let you go, I started by saying, without a real basis, that we're looking like a very dry summer. But given what we've had this spring, that may not be completely out of line. What do you anticipate this summer in terms of things we might have to do to deal with the potential of a dry summer?
Well, for Park City Municipal, we are asking our customers, they are already on an ordinance, if you will, that is ongoing for even odd watering days, as well as no irrigation during the hours that I mentioned between 10 a.m. and 7 p.m. And we would love it, and we are encouraging folks to, even reduce irrigation down by a day or two, if possible, and push off starting your irrigation for as long as you possibly can.
Susan Cardone and Lisa Hoffman, thanks for spending time with me.
Thank you.
We'll be right back after this.
Lands and Natural Resources staffers at Summit County say they're taking time to make sure they get recreation and conservation on the 910 Cattle Ranch right. More than 1 year after an initial survey and public meetings, they showed residents the tentative plan at the Kimball Junction Library on Tuesday. The recreation management plan for the 8,600-acre property that Summit County bought in January is still subject to change. One of dozens in attendance Tuesday, Charlie Sturgis, urged fellow residents to get involved.
But the key to making this project work, because it is a beautiful, large piece of land that's been untouched for a long, long time, is to have public input and have serious public input. I mean, you just can't have an opinion on something like this if you don't show up.
The 910 Ranch is north of Jeremy Ranch and crossed by the unpaved East Canyon Road. The county's plan right now is to split the 910 into three zones with escalating restrictions: a community zone, exploratory zone, and conservation or research zone. The community zone concentrated around East Canyon Road would have the most traffic. It's the only place dog walking may be allowed. The community zone is the smallest of the three areas and would be the first to see hiking and multi-use trails, a visitor center in the ranch house, parking, and potentially an amphitheater. The exploration zone would be about 32% of the property. It would have limited trails for things like hiking, Nordic skiing, mountain biking, and horseback riding. More than half of the ranch would be reserved for conservation and research. Mountain biking won't be allowed there, and any other activity would require a permit. Any events in commercial use would also require permits. There's a laundry list of things that will be prohibited across the whole property, except for on East Canyon Road, which is public. Hunting will be banned, as well as fires, drones, hot air balloons, motor vehicles, and straying from trails. All e-bikes may be banned unless the rider qualifies under disability laws. Fishing will not be allowed pending the restoration of East Canyon Creek. County Lands and Natural Resources Director Jess Kirby says she and her staff may present the proposal to the county council next month. The council can make changes and eventually will vote whether to adopt the plan. The conservation easement on the 910 requires the council to adopt some sort of recreation management plan. Until then, members of the public are not allowed to stray from East Canyon Road. The Summit County Sheriff's Office now patrols the property and will continue to do so. Summit County is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
And you've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.